Hello, friends. We have returned. We are now here with a new episode of Too Scared to Sleep, starring me, Dylan, and Jake.
Hi, and welcome to Zack Snyder's Too Scared to Sleep.
Yes! The Snyder cut of Too Scared to Sleep. Hell yes!
Oh, holy Jesus. Okay, so Zack Snyder's Justice League was available on HBO Max starting at, was it 2 a.m. here? 2 a.m. I woke up at 4 a.m. to take a piss and get a drink of water, and I was laying in bed for about 20 minutes trying to go back to sleep, and I thought, fuck, I'm not going to be able to go back to sleep. What should I do? Justice League.
Justice League.
And so I watched about an hour and a half of it until I found that wave of, oh, I'm falling asleep again, and I came back and crawled back into bed. But during that work day, I watched it in like 30-minute increments, and I was able to get through it about noon or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's awesome. So good.
That movie fucking rocks.
So
the first thing I did when I woke up that morning was grab a soda and then like rearrange my pillows so I could sit comfortably. And I just sat there. I watched the whole thing. Absolutely spectacular. What a true gem. And then I turned around and watched it again that night when I was eating dinner.
So did I. I watched it again. Hell yeah. Twice in a day.
Oh, and it was so worth it. It was so good.
I know.
And I'll say, okay, for those that don't know, it is a 4-hour and 2-minute movie. It does not feel like 4 hours and 2 minutes.
No.
Not at all. But oh boy, it is jam-packed, full of all kinds of shit that just had me gawking. That was the coolest fucking shit in the entire world. Yeah.
And so what that shows is the combined power of nerds like us to be able to manipulate a huge juggernaut of a studio, Warner Brothers, into releasing the Snyder Cut.
Hell yeah.
And now what we have to do is we have to marshal all of those forces and all of that nerddom and all of that energy so that they will restore the Snyderverse.
Restore the Snyderverse.
That's the next thing that we've got to do. Which basically, I don't know. I mean, if you're a nerd, you're probably listening to our podcast. You're probably on the same wavelength that we are. But obviously, Zack Snyder had an idea for basically a vision for all of the Justice League movies to be linked. The same way that the Marvel movies are linked. And they're calling it the Snyderverse as just kind of as in the vernacular, we're calling it the Snyderverse. So.
Because the initial like idea was supposed to be Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, Justice League, then maybe a Batman solo film, but Justice League 2 and Justice League 3. And that was going to be it. That was going to be the universe. And then, of course, fucking Warner Brothers came in and said, no, we're going to turn you into a ripoff Marvel as much as we can. And obviously did not go well because studio interference always goes so well. And I'm sure they thought it was a wonderful idea.
The movie was so good. The character development was so much better.
Oh my God. It was so good.
Oh, of everything that it was better about it was Barry Allen, the Flash. Oh
God. They actually made him into a good character that did things and was useful to the plot and not just a bumbling idiot.
Yeah, because if you watched the original Justice League, which people are calling the Justice League,
yeah.
Because it's Joss Whedon. You know that, okay, early, oh God, here we go again. Early trailers made it seem like Barry Allen was just an awkward teenager or young 20s kid. And then you saw what Joss Whedon put together, and it's like they toyed with this idea that he was maybe on the spectrum somewhere, maybe has a little bit of Asperger's.
Yeah.
And okay, if you want to write a character like that and you want to represent a person on the spectrum like that as being a superhero who is capable of heroic things, that's great.
Yeah,
but
that's awesome.
The only way that they used that was as a comic relief.
Yeah,
and they it was poorly done.
It was very, very cringy. It came across as making fun of people
that
are on the spectrum.
Yes.
When Joss Whedon came in and redid everything.
Mm-hmm. And that was completely absent from the Snyder Cut, and it was so much better. His character development, Cyborg's character development.
Cyborg is, I mean, you've probably heard Zack Snyder say that Cyborg is basically the heart of the film, and he's fucking right.
He is.
He carries, like, the movie is great all around, but he carries so many emotional scenes, and you get to see what a good actor Ray Fisher actually is.
And it's pretty good because within the universe, Cyborg's probably never going to get his own solo movie anyway, because he's not that strong of a character.
But put into this setting, he was perfect.
He was perfect.
He's an amazing support character, and you got to have a lot of the movie actually focus on his mindset. And you see him grow and become more comfortable throughout the movie. And it's fucking amazing. It's so good. And he gets, like, a hold on his powers, and he has to go through emotions and go through shit. But it's fucking great. He does such a good job. It's so good. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand why the Justice League was allowed to be a thing in the first place.
Yeah, it was horrible. But of course, it's studio interference, them getting worried that it doesn't have the same tone as the Marvel movies, which it doesn't, you know, on some level. And this, and Zack Snyder's Justice League was rated R because it had cursing and it had violence and it had blood.
Yes.
And it was cool.
It was fucking radical. It was exactly what they needed, like, yeah, for the world that Zack Snyder was building.
Yeah.
And it was great. And instead, fucking Warner Brothers said, no, go ahead and make a PG-13 version and then just butcher every aspect of it. And Joss Whedon said, sure, no problem. And cut out all the good characters. I got really close to watching the 2017 Justice League again, just to compare them. I can't quite push myself to watch it again. But part of me really wants to. I did go and watch, like, right before the first time Steppenwolf comes down and he has to fight the Amazons, mm-hmm, I did stop and I watched the clip from the 2017 one where Steppenwolf comes down and fights the Amazons. And I was watching it and I was like, wow, this is shittier than I remember it. And then I started watching the actual clip from the real Justice League, mm-hmm, and you get to see how much cooler it actually is, like, just in terms of the Steppenwolf design and how he talks, like, the dialogue that he has. They made Steppenwolf weird and cringy and sound like he has mommy issues in the fucking 2017 version. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But he's an actual, like, badass monster in the real Justice League, and it's just every aspect of it is so good. It makes me so happy.
It's so exciting. We're doing good. Rocking and rolling. Personal life going well. I'm putting my bike in the microwave. In the garage. You want to know why? Because in order to get to my garage, what do I need to do? Because it's in my garage right now. What do I need to do to get to the garage? Go walk past the microwave. Jesus Christ. Putting it in the garage to get it fixed.
Nice.
We're good. What else was I going to tell you? That's about it. I got nothing else. I watched Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which we can watch again in a minute.
Cool, because I forgot that came out. I have not watched that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But tomorrow, which will be, Saturday the 20th, I, along with my roommate Cade, who you may remember from last season, mm-hmm, and our friend Camilla, are going to Roswell.
You're leaving tomorrow?
Yeah, we're leaving tomorrow.
Awesome.
Hell yeah. We're going to get up there, and we... So, when we were first planning this, which was... Our initial plan was to go the Monday after Valentine's Day, which is right when the whole snow thing happened in Texas. Mm-hmm. So obviously we didn't do that. But we made a plan that initially was just going to be me and Cade, and we were going to listen to, because it's about an 8-hour drive, we were going to listen to Dark Tower 1, The Gunslinger.
Nice.
On the way up there.
Favorite book. One of my favorite books ever.
I know. And it's one of mine, too. But it's been a long time since I've read it, and Cade's never read it. So we're going to listen to the audiobook going up there, and then on the way back, I was going to be able to actually start reading the rest of the series like I want to. And we did convince Camilla that she's going to be interested in The Gunslinger, because I had texted her earlier and I was like, hey, just so you know, bud, bring headphones because we're going to be listening to some nerd ass audiobook shit. And after explaining it, she said it actually sounded cool. So plan's still on. That's what I'm hyped for.
That's awesome.
The Gunslinger.
I'm excited for that. Oh, we never even talked about... WandaVision was amazing.
Oh, yeah. WandaVision was fucking awesome.
The best part for me for WandaVision was Catherine Hahn.
I know it was.
I'm all about age-appropriate women.
And that's good.
Oh, it is. Oh, you give me a 40-plus woman, and I would be the happiest man alive.
I will say,
Catherine Hahn
is so good-looking. She's so funny. Very, very attractive.
For me, it was Agatha all along. You mm-hmm. can keep Wanda. I pick Agatha.
I definitely do enjoy seeing a good Wanda Maximoff. Love that. Love her. Spectacular.
It helps that she wears a fucking corset. Mm. We've gone on for long enough.
I suppose we have.
I suppose. Oh, we have such a... one of our listeners sent us a message, and I totally forgot about it. She listens to us, and her husband doesn't like us because he doesn't like things about Texas. Well, thanks a lot, buddy. But she was telling me that they were both listening to our episode where we talked about James Massey killing the seven cows, and they're from up north, where they actually grew up around in a rural area as well. And they were like, seven cows? And I'm like, yeah,
that's fucking crazy. Because that's what's fucking crazy about it. How do you kill that many fucking cows?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
That was exciting.
That's exciting hilarious.
That other people were just as dumbfounded by that.
I know. It is good to know that people are on our side about that.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, okay, I'm going to go first because... because I went hiking today. I took the day off and I went hiking with my family, and I am super tired, but I brought the energy. I'm bringing the heat, bringing the thunder, bringing the hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan. So I've got it. I'm going to go ahead and start in on my topic. I am going to be talking about Jim Jones, who was a cult leader.
Yes.
Jim Jones. I don't know how familiar you are with all of this.
Me personally, incredibly familiar.
Oh.
I love it. Yeah. I'm into some Jim Jones shit.
Okay, here's a funny thing. I remember watching a made-for-TV movie about Jim Jones, and that was basically what I knew about him, other than just, like, you know, watching news articles about him. And I started researching him, and he was wackadoo crazy.
Oh, yeah, he was even into some next-level shit.
Even more so than they ever put in any of this stuff. So I got tons and tons of research on this guy, and it was crazy.
Hell yeah.
So good. So,
real quick,
go
did
ahead.
You ever watch The Sacrament? It's on my Vudu.
No, I've never watched that one.
Okay, it's...
That one's about a cult, right?
That one's inspired by Jonestown.
It is?
Yes. Awesome. If I had known this was going to be your topic, I would have let you know. But the guy that they cast to be, like, the Jim Jones, it's not, like, an actual
right
telling of it, but the guy who's the cult leader there actually looks eerily similar to, like, an old Jim Jones. It's pretty creepy.
Let's see
if I can find it.
Oh, I'm finding it. IMDb never lets me down. You talking about... Oh, Joe Swanberg plays Jake Williams? Is that the cult leader? Probably.
Okay, the guy who plays the cult leader, his name is Gene Jones.
Gene Jones.
That's the actor's name.
Oh. Oh, yeah, he does kind of look like Jim Jones. And they call him father. That mm-hmm. makes sense. They did that with Jim Jones.
Yeah. But especially like with those glasses that he wears. It's been a while since I've seen that movie, but I remember that movie being very, very good. And him in particular being creepy as shit.
Oh, they did definitely. Yes.
Yeah, it's 100% like a Jonestown. Oof. Just with a little bit changed.
All right. Are we ready for this?
All right. Hell yeah. I'm ready.
All right. So Jim Jones was born in May of 1931. And man, right at the beginning of the Depression. So he's old as shit. Economic difficulties during the Great Depression led the family to Indiana, where Jones grew up in a shack without plumbing. That's living rough, baby.
Yeah, that's going to
hit. People don't live that rough anymore. Okay, so from a very early age, Jones was a voracious reader, and he read some really light reading, like Joseph Stalin, Karl Marx, Mao Zedong, Mahatma Gandhi, Adolf Hitler.
Oh.
Just real easy.
Interesting easy assortment there, yeah.
He also developed an intense interest in religion. One writer suggests this was primarily because he found it difficult to make friends. Childhood acquaintances recalled him as a really weird kid who was obsessed with religion and death. They alleged that he frequently held funerals for small animals on his parents' property and that he had stabbed a cat to death. That's always a great beginning to any story that we tell.
Yeah, we'd love that.
Oh, James Massey. Ed Kemper.
God, there's so many people.
So many people. McDonald Triad. Look it up, guys.
Hey, serial killers, because I feel like statistically speaking, at least one serial killer listens to our podcast. Yeah. Hey, serial killers, can you just stop killing small animals, please?
Yeah. Just like break that mold.
We get it. Just be better.
Prove be that like you're a Dexter serial killer where you only kill people who have done something bad?
Yeah.
That wouldn't be so bad.
That's a perfect arrangement. But there's no reason to kill a cute little cat or a cute little dog or seven fucking cows.
We need to make a shirt that looks like kind of looks like the McDonald's logo from far away, but when you get closer to it, it's the McDonald's triad.
McDonald's triad. Oh, that's fucking good, actually.
Right?
I'm glad this is in here because I'm gonna be able to remember that. I'll work on something.
Yeah.
Redbubble
McDonald's triad. McDonald's triad. All right. So, let's see. One childhood acquaintance noted that after German POWs arrived in his town, that's what they would do sometimes. They would ship the POWs over here. Mm-hmm. One patted young Jim Jones on the back of the head, and then Jones responded by giving the Hitler salute and shouting Heil Hitler.
Oh!
Isn't that great?
That's bad and not good.
I'm going to go ahead and say it. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. When you have a kid who exhibits this kind of behavior, the best thing you could do is drown that kid in the tub.
Drown that kid in the tub.
Drown that kid in the tub. Nothing good is going to come from this.
No, absolutely not.
Like that motherfucker who killed all of those poor Asian men and women just 2 days ago.
Yeah.
Drown in the tub.
Should have just fucking killed him.
Drown him in the tub. I'm sorry. Jones had a childhood friend both claim... Jones and a childhood friend both claimed his father was associated with the Ku Klux Klan, which had become very popular in Depression-era Indiana. Why? Because economic downturn makes white people want to look for a fucking scapegoat.
Uh-huh.
God, you fucking assholes.
Gee, Jones. I'm so happy that we have learned from our past.
Oh, yeah. Isn't it great that we've learned from that? None of that kind of thing happens anymore.
Yeah.
God, we've overcome so much. We've come so far. This goddamn forsaken country. Jones recounted how he and his father argued on the issue of race and how he did not speak with his father for many, many years after his dad refused to allow one of Jones's black friends into the house. Jones's parents separated and Jones relocated with his mother to Richmond, Indiana. In December 1948, he graduated from school early with honors from high school. He married a nurse named Marceline Baldwin in 1949, and the two relocated to Bloomington, Indiana.
Okie dokie.
In 1951, he was 20 years old, and he started to attend gatherings of the Communist Party in Indianapolis, the United States Communist Party, and he became flustered with harassment during the McCarthy hearings. You know what that is? Are you aware of what that is?
The McCarthy hearings?
Yes.
I don't remember, no.
There was a senator named McCarthy who held these congressional hearings where he would bring up prominent members of the Communist Party who were also prominent Americans and asked them about their dealings, and he created this blacklist of writers and newspaper reporters and directors and, you know, Hollywood elite.
Yeah, okay.
People who had communist dealings, and so there was a blacklist of people who weren't allowed to, basically they'd ruin their lives because of the communists. And it's really difficult for me, and this is funny because, like, it's one of the things, like, when I watch Peaky Blinders, which is set in pre-World War II England. Mm-hmm. His sister has a husband who's in that, and he's a communist, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And they're always after him about the communists and the communists and the communists. And it's really difficult to me because, I mean, I grew up in the 80s, and the Cold War was coming to an end. It was winding down by the time I was aware of it. It's really hard for me to understand how scary and threatening the communists were, because communism as a whole hasn't taken root in the United States and really hasn't worked anywhere except some very far outreaching crazy places like North Korea and, you know, Cuba.
To be fair, though, a lot of times a lot of times when a communist government is established, and this has happened quite a bit in the past, when a communist government is established, the United States doesn't like that, and they want to set an example of it, so they hire people in the country, or they send their own agents to go in and basically just ruin the idea of communism and, like, bring down the government from the inside for it.
Are you telling me that oh my God, did I drink the Kool-Aid?
You drank the Kool-Aid a little bit, my friend. Right. Because communism would work in some areas. I know some places, it doesn't happen every single time. Some places, communism just doesn't work out. You know, they put the wrong ideas in place for the wrong people in power.
I'm going to talk about Cambodia and Year Zero one of these days.
Hell yes. Absolutely.
That's fucking disgusting shit.
Yes, definitely. But yeah, the U.S. government, usually like the CIA, will actually hire people or put in their own people to take down the government from the inside and just make it look like communism fails everywhere.
Okay.
So,
okay. So Jim Jones got flustered with the McCarthy hearings, particularly regarding an event that he attended with his mother focusing on Paul Robeson, after which she was harassed by the FBI in front of her coworkers for attending. So the feds came after his mom. He also became frustrated with the persecution of open and accused communists in the United States, especially during the trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were tried for treason. Jones said he asked himself, how can I demonstrate my Marxism? The thought was, infiltrate the church.
Hell yes.
Oh my God. A recipe for disaster with this guy. Jones was surprised when a Methodist district superintendent helped him get a start in the church, even though he knew Jones to be a communist. In 1952, he became a student pastor at the Somerset Southside Methodist Church. Hallelujah. But later claimed that he left the church because its leaders forbade him from integrating blacks into his congregation. This is a theme with Jones. Around this time, Jones witnessed a faith healing service at a Seventh-day Baptist church. He observed that it attracted people and their money, and he concluded that he could accomplish his social goals with financial resources from such services. Here we go. So, he's getting an idea of how to run this fucking racket. Not only that, but guess what, ladies and gentlemen? Churches are tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
Tax shelters. Jones organized a mammoth religious convention that took place between June 11th and 15th in 1956 in a place called Cadle Tabernacle. Needing a well-known religious figure to draw crowds, he arranged to share the pulpit with a Reverend William M. Branham, a healing evangelist and religious author who was very well revered within his community. Jones was able to begin his own church after the convention, which had various names until it became the People's Temple Christian Full Church Gospel. Hallelujah.
Alrighty.
The People's Temple was initially an interracial mission, which is another thing. Like I told you, it keeps going this way. Jones was known to regularly study Adolf Hitler and this other guy, this crazy cult leader named Father Divine, which I didn't know about, but look him up, guys. He studied these two guys to manipulate members of the cult. Father Divine is a guy who he basically shrouded himself in so much secrecy, people don't know what his real fucking name was.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But he would go around telling people that he was Jesus and then he was a prophet, then he was the second coming, all this crazy shit.
Hmm.
Divine told Jones personally to find an enemy and to make sure they know your congregation, make sure your congregation knows who the enemy is, as it will unify those in the group and make them subservient to him.
Ew.
Does this sound familiar to you? Anyone else lately do this? Yeah. Find an enemy and make sure you know who the enemy is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about Donald fucking Trump. Stupid, just in case none of you know. I have a right in this country to say what I want to about him. And fuck that asshole. Okay, so in 1953, the New York Times reported this, declaring that he was outraged at what he perceived as racial discrimination in his white congregation. Jim Jones established his own church and pointedly opened it to all ethnic groups to raise money. What? He imported monkeys and sold them door-to-door as pets? How are you getting away with this in 1953?
What in tarnation?
Jeez.
I mean, it was 1953. Did they really care about anything other than communism?
That's true. You could probably still get heroin at the drugstore at the time.
Oh, absolutely.
In 1953. Like, oh, yeah. You got a cocaine addiction? No problem. We've got something for you. It's called heroin. It's no big deal.
You got ghosts in your asshole. Take some cocaine about it.
Take some cocaine about it. So in 1960, Indianapolis Mayor Charles Boswell appointed Jones director of the local Human Rights Commission. Jones ignored Boswell's advice to keep low profile, however, finding new outlets for his views on local radio and television programs. The mayor and other commissioners asked him to curtail his public actions, but he resisted. He was wildly cheered at the meeting of the NAACP and Urban League when he yelled for his audience to be more militant and then climaxed with, "Let my people go." Which is nothing that Moses ever said, but something that Charlton Heston said.
Yeah. Oh, and Val Kilmer.
Churches are so, yes. Oh, God. Prince of Egypt. Were you guys watching Prince of Egypt?
Yeah, we watched it a couple days ago.
You guys are so crazy. I grew up, it's funny that I'm talking about a cult leader because I told you I grew up in a deeply religious Baptist family and that I was made to go to Christian school my entire life. And that I went to a Baptist University as well, so I feel like I grew up in a cult.
Because you did.
Prince of Egypt was heavy on that rotation of movies that we were allowed to watch.
I can appreciate the art in Prince of Egypt. It is very preachy.
Oh, it's extreme. Obviously.
I mean, yeah, it's a propaganda film. It's the story
of Moses.
Yeah. But looking at the cast, I did not realize how incredibly white the cast is for a group of entirely Africans.
Jeff Goldblum is Jewish.
He has such a small part in that, though.
I know, but I don't know what to tell you. I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer and Val Kilmer, really? Danny exactly. Glover. I mean, Danny Glover works all right.
Yeah, he's but okay. He's...
I know, wait, Ralph Fiennes, really? Now listen, but okay. That's like an all-star cast. You know what's
it
funny?
It is a good cast, but it's such a this? White cast. Also, oh. Tell me, like, I get why they made... Well,
this is before woke culture would have fixed that shit.
I
mean, shit.
I know. I'm not expecting much of it. It's an old animated movie, but, like, my main beef with it, and I get why they did it.
Sandra Bullock as Miriam, his sister?
No, actually, I did forget about that. But no, I'm talking about Val Kilmer as the main character. And I get why you want the main character's voice to be the same as God's voice, but why is God voiced by Val Kilmer? It takes me out of it every time because I'm just imagining God looking at me and it's just Val Kilmer.
If God looked like Val Kilmer from Top Gun, I would totally believe that.
But see, I don't picture Val Kilmer from Top Gun.
You don't? Who do you picture?
I picture modern day Val Kilmer. Well, not day looking Val so Kilmer hot.
Looks like 250 pounds of chewed up bubble gum.
Exactly. And that's what I picture when I listen to
his
it.
His face is falling.
Yes, I am aware. And I, you know.
Man, if the Jewish American God showed up today and he looked like Val Kilmer.
If he looked like that image of Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer looks so bad right now. That looks like a 65-year-old woman who is like a top executive at Avon. That's what that looks like.
Yes, and that's He's what I now rough. Picture but God if, to look if, like in if, The Prince of Egypt.
If God, Elohim, that God, showed up and looked like Iceman from Top Gun, I totally believe that.
A young Val Kilmer, I'd worship I can that get God. That. But this Val Kilmer?
I'd set up my own church and have a photo of him and be like, this is the guy. Anyway, you know what's funny about that? Here we go. What the fuck? Here we go. DreamWorks was making... Prince of Egypt at the same time that they were making Shrek, but they were putting all their money and resources into Prince of Egypt.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that the animators that were working, if they started slipping up or caused problems, they got sent to work on Shrek.
I remember that.
Like getting sent to the dungeon to work on Shrek. It was like the throwaway project.
It was their punishment was to go work and on
they made
Shrek.
Like, what, 9 Shrek movies? Oh, some God, shit
there's
like that.
So many.
There's like 9 Shrek movies.
Also, I just want to say, Val Kilmer as Jim Morrison in The Doors. I could see that Val Kilmer being God. That's a good-looking Val Kilmer.
That's true. We should circulate that. Easter's coming up. That photo of Val Kilmer from The Doors.
He's got, like, arms outstretched and shirtless. Yes. Yeah.
Can I get a like for our Lord and Savior? See how many fundamental Christians on our Facebook page don't realize who it is? We are so far off. They're so far there's down this rabbit hole.
There's a post that I've seen of...
I always post the one about Obi-Wan. Ewan McGregor's Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah.
At Easter time, he is our only hope. And I always catch a couple of people from my past who like that photo because they think it's Jesus. And it's like, no, that's Obi-Wan. That's so that's Ewan McGregor
as Obi-Wan Kenobi. Which is a better version of Jesus, one could say.
Oh, well, he's our only hope. What did I just say?
Exactly. Yeah, but I love seeing when, like, people go and visit their religious families and they replace the Jesus pictures with the Ewan McGregor pictures. That's my favorite thing. It's so good.
Okay, so we need to do that at my dad's house.
That would be fucking hilarious.
Oh, my dad and my mom's house. That would be so awesome.
You definitely need to do that.
Get them a photo and put it up there. Oh my God. They'd love it.
That would be delightful.
I grew up in a cult. Let me tell you why. Oh God, here we go again. There was this actor named Rock Hudson. You don't even know who he is.
Mm-mm.
Rock Hudson was like the Hugh Jackman of the 1950s. Mm. The man's man, super, just like really talented, really good actor. He did comedies, he did dramas, he played, you know, hardboiled detective, he played a swashbuckler, he played cowboys and stuff. He was in a movie called Giant, where the other two big name actors were Elizabeth Taylor and James Dean.
Okay.
Another cool guy.
Yes.
Okay, so he's in this movie. He's a really good actor, very handsome guy, like 6'5", you know, just strapping, like the epitome of man, right? Okay. Rock Hudson was closeted gay his entire life, which is sad and unfortunate. I don't say that to try to make fun of it. It's sad and unfortunate that he had to live his life that way, and he actually died of AIDS. And a couple of months before he succumbed to the illness, he was persuaded by his family to come out and speak, because the idea was that you've lived this way long enough, you need to be true to yourself. Not only that, but maybe you can raise awareness and help support AIDS. Because I don't know if you kids are probably too young to realize this, but the AIDS epidemic went untreated for so long in this country. And one of the reasons was is because our fucking Judeo-Christian society thought, oh, well, it's just the gays getting it. This is their punishment from God. We just won't do anything about it. Okay. Just like, I mean, it's like we haven't learned anything because we did the same thing with COVID. We are so far off. Anyway, here's the thing. I went to high school with a girl who was also a pastor's daughter. And one time we were talking about favorite movies, and she was so sheltered. She's one of these girls who was like not allowed to wear blue jeans or shorts or a bikini, God forbid. She was so sheltered that she didn't watch current movies. She only watched 1950s movies, like Rock Hudson movies. Rock Hudson made movies with Doris Day. And I looked at her one day and I said, you know, he was gay. And she goes, what? And I said, yeah, Rock Hudson was gay. Because she was talking about how much she loved him and she wanted to find a man just like him. I'm like,
well, you don't want a man like him.
You don't want a man. A man just like him isn't going to want anything to do with you.
Yeah.
Anyway. But she was just like, she was just deflated after I said that because of just the way that it, God, because of the way, how sheltered she was. We're so far off. Oh, man.
You just threw a wrench straight into her brain gears.
Oh, yeah.
Just short-circuited that poor girl.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, we're so far off.
Yeah, let's get back to the creepy cult dude.
Okay, so during the 1950s, Jones helped to racially integrate churches, restaurants, the telephone company, the Indianapolis Police Department, a theater, an amusement park, and the Indiana University Health Methodist Hospital. Jesus Christ.
Damn.
Now, you got to admit, I mean, that's not bad to do.
Yeah, no.
But his motives were horrible.
Well, yeah, but
later on he's the villain who starts off seemingly nice. Okay, swastikas were painted on the homes of two black families, and Jones walked through the neighborhood comforting local black people and counseling white families not to move. He set up sting operations to catch restaurants refusing to serve black customers, and wrote to American Nazi leaders passing their responses to the media. He was accidentally placed in the black ward of a hospital after a collapse in 1961, but refused to be moved. He began to make beds and empty the bedpans of black patients. Political pressures resulting from Jones's actions caused hospital officials to desegregate the wards. So that's good. But his motives are horrible.
Yeah.
He has not revealed himself yet.
Yeah. He's so far worked on, like, you know, doing some pretty good things, but we're just waiting for that other shoe to drop. We know it doesn't end there.
Oh, it's going to drop.
I know it will.
Oh, it's going to drop. Jones received considerable criticism in Indiana for his integrationist views. Likewise, white-owned businesses and locals were critical of him. So a swastika was placed on the temple. A stick of dynamite was left in the temple coal pile.
Jesus.
And a dead cat was thrown at Jones's house after a threatening phone call, and other incidences occurred. Okay, I will say, having a dead cat thrown at his house, that's fucking karma for killing cats when you were a kid.
That's a good point. Fuck that guy.
I mean, if he looked and opened his door and said, oh, that's a dead cat, I hope that the thing that went through his head was, well, I used to kill cats when I was a kid, so I can't really, I mean, he who's without sin, let him cast the first cat.
Nice.
Okay, so Jones and his wife ended up adopting several non-white children. And he referred to his household as his rainbow family and stated, integration is a more personal thing with me now. It's a question of my son's future. He also portrayed the temple as a rainbow family. So, God, he adopted a bunch of different kids. three Korean American children. He adopted a Native American child. He encouraged temple members to adopt orphans from war-ravaged Korea. He was also critical of the U.S. opposition to communist leader Kim Il-sung's 1950 invasion of South Korea and called it a war of liberation and stated that South Korea is a living example of all that socialism in the North has overcome. Oh, please. Give me a fucking break. But anyway, I digress. Jones traveled. Okay, here's what happened. At some point, there was a news article that was written that was talking about how the world in the 1960s, in the early 1960s, was on the brink of nuclear war, which we actually were. This is right before the Cuban Missile Crisis. Shit was real.
Mm-hmm.
Shit was getting real. We were amassing atomic bombs, and so was the fucking Soviet Union, and we were on the brink of destruction because we didn't know who's gonna do it. I remember, like I said, because I'm older than you are, but I remember thinking, oh my God, what happens if we launch nukes? You know?
Yeah.
What are we going to do? So
nothing.
This news article that was written basically talked about how close we were to being that way, and the doomsday clock was like 5 minutes to midnight, which means we're really close to nuclear holocaust and the total destruction and the extinction of the human race. And it also listed a couple of places on the earth that were deemed the safest if there was a nuclear holocaust. And one of the places was called Belo Horizonte, Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another one in Northern California. So Jones sent his second in command to Northern California to try to decide if that would be a good place for them to move so that they could set up like a different church. Like they wanted to move from Indiana over to Arizona. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things that he wanted to do. But what he did was he sent a second in command to California. He went with his family to Brazil to see whether or not they could set up a temple there. Right. After preaching at the temple about the fears of nuclear holocaust, blah, 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 blah. Oh, it was Esquire. And it was in 1962. That's when he went over there. He went to Brazil, but on his way, he made his first trip to Guyana, which was a British colony at the time. Also in South America. The family rented a 3-bedroom home in Brazil in Belo Horizonte, and Jones studied the local economy and the receptiveness of racial minorities to his message. Although language remained a barrier because they speak Portuguese, not Spanish down there, he also explored local Brazilian syncretistic religions, and he was careful not to portray himself as a communist in a foreign country. Because that was not a thing you could do in South America as much as you could up here. He spoke of an apostolic communal lifestyle rather than of Castro and Marx and Marcus lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, if you read the Bible and you know these things, at the very beginning of the church of the formed church after Jesus was killed and crucified and rose from the dead, they lived in a communal lifestyle there. They sold all of their possessions and they just lived communally. So that's what he's saying. He also went to Rio de Janeiro in mid-1963 and worked with the poor in the slums. But he became plagued by the guilt of leaving the Indiana civil rights struggle behind. And he was afraid that he would lose what he had built there. His associate preachers in Indiana told him the temple was about to collapse without him, so he returned. Once returned from Brazil in December of 63, he told his Indiana congregation that the world would be engulfed by nuclear war on July 15th, 1967, and that it would lead to a new socialist Eden on Earth, and that the temple had to move to Northern California for safety.
Okay.
Accordingly, the temple began to move to Redwood Valley, California, near the city of Ukiah. Let's just say it's Ukiah. I don't know what it is. According to religious studies professor Catherine Wissinger, Jones always spoke of the social gospel's virtues, but he chose to conceal that his gospel was actually communism until the late 1960s.
Okay.
Right? He's just thinly veiling it. Mm-hmm. But by that time, he'd begin partially revealing the details of his apostolic socialism, which would be what he called it, he started to integrate it into his sermons. He also taught that those who remained drugged with the opiate of religion, that's from Marx, had to be brought to enlightenment, which would be socialism. He often mixed these ideas in his preaching.
Mm-hmm.
What did he say? If you're born in capitalist America, racist America, fascist America, then you're born in sin. But if you're born in socialism, you're not born in sin. So that was one of the things that he was quoted as saying during his sermons. He is wackadoo crazy. So, by the early 1970s, Jones began deriding Christianity as a flyaway religion. So here he goes. See,
Yeah.
Here he goes. Rejecting the Bible as being a tool to oppress women and non-whites and denouncing the sky god, who was no god at all. He wrote a booklet titled The Letter Killed. I feel bad because I'm on the fence on this. Maybe I can just say that I'm agnostic.
Yeah. So, hey, man.
It's hard.
2021, live your truth.
It's hard to fully leave the cult when you've been in it for so long.
That's what I've heard.
You got to admit. I mean, that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
So he denounced the sky god. And he wrote a book titled The Letter Killeth, criticizing the King James Bible. Jones also began preaching that he was the reincarnation of Gandhi, Father Divine, Jesus, Gautama Buddha, and Vladimir Lenin. You got to pick one.
He's definitely losing me here.
Yes. So he was quoted as saying by one of the other temple leaders, what you need to believe in is what you can see. If you see me as your friend, I'll be your friend. As you see me as your father, I'll be your father. For those of you that don't have a father, if you see me as your savior, I'll be your savior. If you see me as your God, I'll be your God.
Okay.
Gone off the rails.
Yeah, he's definitely
he's gone off the rails.
Dipping more than a toe into the crazy pool.
In a 1976 phone conversation with John Marr, Jones alternately said he was an agnostic and an atheist. Marceline Jones, that's his wife, admitted in a 1977 New York Times interview that Jones was trying to promote Marxism in the U.S. by mobilizing people through religion, citing Mao as his inspiration. Jim used religion to try to get some people out of the opiate of religion, that's from Marx. He had slammed the Bible on the table yelling, I've got to destroy this paper idol. In one sermon, Jones said, you're going to help yourself or you're going to get no help. There's only one hope of glory that's within you. Nobody's going to come out of the sky. There's no heaven up there. We'll have to make our heaven down here. Within 5 years of moving to California, the temple experienced a period of exponential growth and opened branches in cities including San Fernando, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. By the early 70s, Jones began shifting his focus to major cities because of limited expansion opportunities in Ukiah, California. He eventually moved the temple's headquarters to San Francisco, which was a major center for radical protest movements, where both Jones and the temple became influential in San Francisco politics. Here it comes, culminating in the temple's instrumental role in George Moscone's mayoral victory in 75. Moscone subsequently appointed Jones as chairman of the San Francisco Housing Authority Commission. Jones was also able to gain contact with prominent politicians at the local and national level. So here he goes. He's rising in power. For example, he and Moscone met privately with vice presidential candidate Walter Mondale on his campaign plane days before the 1976 election, leading Mondale to publicly praise the temple. First Lady Rosalind Carter also met with Jones on multiple occasions, corresponded with him about Cuba, and spoke with him at the grand opening of the San Francisco headquarters, where he received louder applause than she did.
Nice.
One of the things that happened was the campaign promoters had contacted Jones and said, we want you to speak, and if you can, bring some people. And he showed up with like 500 people on buses. Oh, so God. The majority of the people, there were maybe 700 people there, 500 of them were from the People's Temple.
That is fucking crazy.
So he actually received more, applause than Rosalind Carter. Not only that, but this article that I read talked about how the campaign promoters got all of these letters from accordingly supporters saying that how great it was to have Jones there. But they showed up the day after the event, which means they had to have been written and mailed before the event.
Yeah.
So he had his own people do it, which is that's a whole other thing that I'm going to talk about eventually.
It's so fucking weird, man.
In September 76, California Assemblyman Willie Brown served as master of ceremonies at a large testimonial dinner for Jones, attended by Governor Jerry Brown and Lieutenant Governor Mervyn DeMille. At that dinner, Brown toted Jones as what you should see every day when you look in the mirror. And he said he was a combination of Martin Luther King, Angela Davis, Albert Einstein, and Mao Zedong. Harvey Milk spoke to the audiences during political rallies at the temple, and he wrote to Jones after one such visit. This is what he said. Reverend Jim, it may take me many a day to come back down from the high that I reached today. I found something dear today. I found a sense of being that makes up for all the hours and energy placed in a fight. I found what you wanted me to find. I shall be back, for I can never leave. So he's impressing a lot of people.
Sounds like it.
Mm-hmm. Jones hosted local political figures at his San Francisco apartment for discussions, including Angela Davis. He spoke with publisher Carlton Goodlett of the San Francisco Sun-Reporter about his remorse over not being able to travel to socialist countries such as the People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union, so speculating that he could be chief dairyman of the USSR. His criticisms led to increased tensions with the Nation of Islam, so Jones spoke at a huge rally in the Los Angeles Convention Center that was attended by many of his closest political acquaintances, hoping to close the rift between the two groups. Jones also forged alliances with key columnists and others at the San Francisco Chronicle and other press outlets, although the move to San Francisco also brought increasing media scrutiny. Encountering resistance to publishing an expose, Chronicle reporter Marshall Kilduff brought his story to the New West magazine. In the summer of 1977, Jones and several hundred temple members abruptly decided to move to the temple's compound in Guyana after they learned the contents of Kilduff's article, which included allegations by former temple members that they were physically, emotionally, and sexually abused.
Oh.
Okay, so I read the article. It's 6 pages long. It's really good. It talks about how he manipulated people. He started off by talking about how he wanted them to live this apostolic communal living. Mm-hmm. And so he would have them sign over the deeds to their homes, and then they would sell all of their possessions. They were left with nothing, which is exactly what people do when they want to control you in a cult. So they were giving everything to him, right? Mm-hmm. Signing over their property. They were forced to sign this paper that was blank. And they were told, if you ever try to leave, we're going to write whatever the shit we want on this paper. And it's signed by you. And we're going to just spread it around with as many lies as we can, which is something that the Scientologists do as well.
Yeah. That's also bad news bears. Mm-hmm.
He would make them do these letter writing campaigns to politicians and fundraising campaigns as well, where people in his people's temple were required to write hundreds of these letters at a time.
Damn.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes using assumed names, which ties into that whole Rosalind Carter political support thing. Those letters were written by his followers.
Yeah.
And they were mailed before the event.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Some of the other things that he did, he would pass around the offering plate, and sometimes they would pick up like $15,000, and then he would have somebody go out and say, folks, we need more money. We only collected $700. That's not our goal. To try to drum up even more money.
Jesus.
He would bring people up. He had people. Okay. So they would all snitch on each other within the people's temple in the community. This is what the newspaper this newspaper article talks about. They would snitch on each other. And then he would have these discipline sessions where he would bring people up and they'd say, well, brother so-and-so said you did this, or brother so-and-so said you did that. And then he would berate them verbally. Sometimes he would have other people beat them up. He had one girl paddled because she gave a she. There was a this teenage girl that was in his congregation saw a friend of hers who had been in the temple for a while, but her friend had left because she was a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so she came back to visit, and she gave her a hug, and people thought that she had hugged her too much, and so this girl was put on the pulpit and paddled, spanked. With a paddle, 75 times.
Holy shit.
She wrote down, I couldn't sit for a day and a half.
Oh my God. Because my
butt was so raw.
What the fuck?
Mm-hmm. So they were beating people up. They would force them to go to like 6-hour services just to keep them exhausted. They would leave like San Francisco. They would have like a church service on Friday night for 6 hours, then get on a bus, drive all the way down to Los Angeles, do like 3 different events on Saturday and Sunday, and then drive back, so they were exhausted all the time.
Oh my God.
He would do healing services where he would report that he cured people of cancer.
Oh.
But he's doing the old, which we see this all the time in healing service, the old switcheroo, where it turns out it's just chicken livers, and they're just saying, oh my God, it's the tumor, but it's fucking chicken liver.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what you're talking about. It's just
sleight of hand and misdirection.
Mm-hmm.
One time he reportedly shot himself and came back to life to prove that he was a god.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What else did he do? Yeah, and there was also reports there that he had sexual relations with female and male members of his congregation in order to strengthen their relationship with the church.
Yet they will paddle someone 75 times for hugging someone of the same sex.
Exactly. Longer than need be. Not only that, but they had a home for troubled children.
Oh,
and none of the money that they were getting from the state was going to those kids. It was just being funneled into the church.
Of course.
He had bodyguards all the time. He had locks on the doors at his church. No one was allowed to just drop into the church. You had to, like, make a fucking appointment. Because he would do all kinds of crazy, wackadoo stuff while he was in the congregation. And at the same time, we see how he's just, like, he started off preaching the gospel. Mm-hmm. And then it slowly and slowly and slowly he moved over.
Yeah, he just kept taking more and more steps off the deep end.
Mm-hmm. But by the time you're ready to say, wait, this is crazy, you've lost everything to the People's Temple.
Mm-hmm. You're in too far.
This news article talks about they had like 10 people report. Like, they had 10 people who had come forward and talked to the reporter about all of the abuse and manipulation. And the one thing that they all said was, by the time we were ready to leave, we couldn't leave because we had nothing. We had given him everything. We had quit our jobs. We had sold all of our property. We had cut ourselves off from our family members. We had nowhere to go. We would have been left penniless, homeless.
Jesus, that is so sad.
Which is exactly what, I mean, that's exactly what all these cults do.
Yeah.
Okay, so that news article was about to be run, and so that's why Jones took his members down to Guyana, and he named the settlement Jonestown after himself. They had originally called it the People's Temple Agricultural Project. It was promoted as a means to create a socialist paradise and a sanctuary for media scrutiny in San Francisco. Jones purported to establish it as a model communist community, adding that the temple comprised the purest communists there are. He did not, however, permit members to leave Jonestown. Of course. Religious scholar Mary McCormick Maga argues that Jones's authority decreased after he moved to the isolated commune because he was not needed for recruitment and he could not hide his drug addiction from rank and file members. He was on a lot of drugs. In spite of the allegations prior to Jones's departure, he was still respected by some for setting up racially mixed church, which helped the disadvantaged. 68% of Jonestown residents were black. Jones began to propagate his belief in what he termed translation. Once they were in Jonestown, where he and his followers would all die together and move on to another plane and live blissfully. So he's already starting to spread this idea of a suicide cult.
We love to see it.
Mm-hmm. Jones claimed that he was a biological father of one of his congregants, and that he fathered a bunch of other kids there while he was there. So, in autumn of 1977, some of the members who had left the temple formed a concerned relatives group because they had family members in Jonestown. This one particular guy named Tim Stone traveled to Washington, D.C., and in January 1978, he visited the State Department officials and members of Congress, and he wrote a white paper detailing his grievances against Jones and the temple. His efforts aroused the curiosity of California Congressman Leo Ryan, who wrote a letter on Stone's behalf to the Guyanese Prime Minister. The concerned relatives also began a legal battle with the temple over custody of Stone's son, John, who was still there. Most of Jones's political allies broke ties after his departure, though some did not. Willie Brown spoke out against enemies at a rally that was attended by Harvey Milk and Assemblyman Art Agnos. On February 19, 1978, Milk wrote a letter to President Jimmy Carter defending Jones as a man of the highest character, and he claimed that escaped temple members were trying to damage Reverend Jones's reputation with an apparent bold-faced lies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Moscone's
I'm sure.
office issued a press release saying that Jones had broken no laws. On April 11th, 78, the concerned relatives distributed a packet of documents, letters, and affidavits to the People's Temple, members of the press, and members of Congress, which they titled Accusation of Human Rights Violations by Reverend James Warren Jones. In June 78, escaped temple member Deborah Layton provided the group with a further affidavit detailing crimes by the temple and substandard living conditions in Jonestown. Jones was facing increased scrutiny in the summer of 78 when he hired JFK assassination conspiracy theorists Mark Lane and Donald Freed to help them make the case of a grand conspiracy against the temple by U.S. intelligence agencies. Jones told Lane that he wanted to pull an Eldridge Cleaver, who was a member of the Black Panthers, who was able to return to the U.S. after he repaired his reputation. So that's what he wanted. In 78, here it goes. In 78, Congressman Leo Ryan led a fact-finding mission to Jonestown to investigate allegations of human rights abuses. His delegation included relatives of Temple members, an NBC camera crew, and reporters from various newspapers. The group arrived in the Guyanese capital of Georgetown on November 15th. 2 days later, they traveled by airplane to Port Kaituma, then they were transported to Jonestown encampment in a limousine. Jones hosted a reception for the delegation that evening at the Central Pavilion, during which Temple member Vernon Gosney passed a note meant for Ryan to one of the newsmen, requesting assistance for himself and other Temple member Monica Bagby in defecting from Jonestown. The delegation had to leave hurriedly the afternoon of November 18th, which is the day after, because a Temple member by the name of Don Sly attacked Ryan with a knife.
Groovy.
Even though it was thwarted. Ryan and his delegation managed to take along 15 Temple members who had expressed a wish to leave. Jones let them, you know, he got up and said, we're going to leave if anybody wants to go. 15 people did it. Jones made no attempt to prevent their departure at that time. As members of this delegation boarded two planes at the airstrip, Jones's armed guards, called the Red Brigade, arrived on a tractor and a trailer and began shooting at them. The gunman killed Ryan and four others near the plane. At the same time, one of the supposed defectors, Larry Layton, drew a weapon and began firing on members of that party. Firstly, Gosney, who had already boarded the small Cessna, an NBC cameraman, was able to capture footage of the first few seconds of the shooting. Okay, so, yeah, one of the defectors was actually not a defector. You get that?
Mm-hmm.
He pulled the gun and started shooting the other people.
Yeah.
The five that were killed at the airstrip were Congressman Ryan, an NBC reporter named Don Harris, an NBC cameraman named Bob Brown, San Francisco Examiner photographer Greg Robinson, and Temple member Patricia Parks. And the other people survived. Later that same day, on November 18th, 1978, 909 inhabitants of Jonestown, 304 of those who were children, died of apparent cyanide poisoning, mostly in and around the settlement's main pavilion. This resulted in the greatest single loss of American civilian life in a deliberate act until September the 11th. The FBI later recovered a 45-minute audio recording of the suicide in progress, and you can listen to it, and it is fucking horrible.
Oh, boy. I don't think that I have listened to that, actually, and it's I don't know how I have
it. Sure, you could find it on YouTube. On that tape, Jones tells Temple members that the Soviet Union, with whom the Temple had been negotiating a potential exodus for months, would not take them after the airstrip murders. The reason given by Jones to commit suicide was consistent with his previously stated conspiracy theories of intelligence organizations allegedly conspiring against the Temple. He said that men would parachute in here on us, shoot some of our innocent babies, and they'll torture our children, they'll torture some of our people here, they'll torture our seniors. Jones's prior statements that hostile forces would convert captured children to fascism would lead many members who held strong opposing views to fascism to view suicide as valid. A lot of these people were just brainwashed at this point.
Yeah, of course.
With that reasoning, Jones and several members argued that the group should commit revolutionary suicide by drinking cyanide-laced grape-flavored Flavor-Aid. They actually didn't drink Kool-Aid.
Flavor-Aid. Mm-hmm.
But that's where that saying comes from.
Yeah.
Let's see here. When members apparently cried, Jones counseled, stop these hysterics. This is not the way for people who are socialists or communists to die. No way for us to die. We must die with some dignity. Jones got to be heard saying, don't be afraid to die. Death is just stepping over into another plane, and that it's a friend. Jones's wife, Marceline, apparently protested killing the children, but she was forcibly restrained and then joined the other adults in poisoning herself. At the end of the tape, Jones concludes, we didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide, protesting the conditions of an inhumane world. Some of his sons survived.
Really?
They were actually at a basketball game in the capital city, and so they weren't in. They weren't at the compound.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. According to some of the escaping temple members, some of the temple members were able to escape. Children were given the drink first by their parents, and then families were told to lie down together. Rhodes also reported that being in close contact to dying children, mass suicide had been previously discussed, and they simulated this on a regular basis, where Jones would wake everybody up in the middle of the night and gather them there and say that they're coming for us, they're going to kill us, we need to commit suicide, and they would put this stuff out there. They would put all of the, they would start the, you know, they would put out the Kool-Aid, and everybody was made to drink it. And everybody would lay down, and he'd say, "This is just a false alarm. I was just testing you."
I remember hearing about that, about their, like, false alarms, their drills, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That was weird.
Suicide drills.
Mm-hmm.
Following the mass murder-suicide, Jones was found dead on the floor. He was resting on a pillow near his deck chair with a gunshot wound to his head, which Guyanese coroner Cyril Mutu said was consistent with suicide. His body was later dragged outside for examination and embalming. The official autopsy conducted in December of 78 also confirms his death as a suicide. Jones' son, Stephen, thinks that maybe he had somebody else shoot him, but it's just speculation. An autopsy showed levels of the barbiturate pentobarbital, what does it matter, which may have been lethal to humans who had not developed a psychological tolerance. So he was high on shit.
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm. So it all ended in mass suicide. 909 people, 300 of which were children. A third of them were children, committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the end of this crazy wackadoo, Jim Jones.
Jesus Christ, my friend.
Wild, wild, wild.
Goodness gracious, yes.
So crazy.
Jim Jones, Flavor Aid, woof.
Exactly. All right, that's it.
All righty. Well, on that note, we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with my topic.
Awesome.
Yeehaw. Alrighty, and we have returned. You know, I was having a thought the other day, and I wonder how weird it is for people that don't know what's going on when they listen to the episodes, and then we just say, "We'll be right back," and then it's just a second later and we start talking again because we don't have any ads.
You can always blame me and say, "We have to say that because Jake can't make it all the way through an episode without having to use the bathroom."
That is true.
Because he's old and he drinks a lot of water during the day.
Yes, that is definitely true. But also, it would be cool if we got ads.
Yeah, but in order to get ads, we need more listeners.
We need more listeners.
And that's what we need your help for. Also, I always feel bad because we always talk about our Patreon. Listen, we're not trying to get rich off this thing. If you sent us money through Patreon or something else, sponsorships, buying our t-shirts, it's going straight into advertisement. We're just trying to get more listeners.
Yeah, that's all we're doing.
We're not trying to make any profit off of this thing.
Yeah, we are definitely, when you add up the cost of all of the, like, mics and the equipment and
but we bought all that shit to begin with. Shit. We bought that on our terms.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, when you compare that to the amount of money that we have made from, like, merch sales or, you know, directly through Anchor, we are definitely in the negative.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah, we put some dollars into this. And like Jake said, we're not trying to get rich. I mean, it would be fucking radical if this could just be what we do for work. That's my dream.
But even so, like, I would like to get to a point where we have, like, you know, we're trying to grow the listeners, twice the number of listeners. I'd love it if we could get 400 listeners, mm-hmm. unique listeners.
Yeah.
What else was I going to say? If you're listening to us in reverse, just so you know, when we first started this podcast 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, I gave plasma for 6 months consistently so that we could buy equipment.
I know. And I do feel really bad about that because neither I nor Annabelle could do that mm-hmm. because we have autoimmune issues. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have the option of going out and, you know, selling blood or selling plasma.
But I had to because I'm healthy and I'm just a specimen.
And Jake did that. He died on that hill for us.
I did.
And we are forever in your debt.
And 3 days later, I rose again. Hallelujah.
Praise be.
Hallelujah. I spent the day with my dad today hiking, and oh my God, the stories that he tells. Oh, they always turn into sermons, I swear to Christ.
I fucking knew it. I knew they would.
He says, have you watched the documentary about the founder of Chick-fil-A? I'm like, oh, here we go.
Oh, that's a terrible
Here we go. Anyway, I just felt like saying that. Because at the end of the story, I was like, is it time for the offering yet? Shall I start up the hymn, Dad? Yeah, it's just really funny. Sorry, I got off. We need to make that McDonald Triad t-shirt.
I have the McDonald, like, I looked up McDonald Triad, and I kept it here to keep the ideas going. Yeah, I really think that's going to be very, very good.
Yeah.
Very excited for that.
All right. I'm sorry, Dylan.
All right.
Let's hear your topic. Okay.
I'll forgive you this time.
This time.
So, for my story, I know mass suicide is, you know, spooky. Jim Jones, manipulative, evil, gross man. I'm going to go ahead and throw out some content warnings on mine. This is a rough one. I specifically looked up horrible, gruesome, true crime cases. And just finished the notes on this right before we started recording. So, I don't want to say exactly for what, like, the content warning is, because I don't want to spoil it. Because I'm going to take you on a narrative journey here. But this one's going to get rough, so just strap in. So, we're going to start this off. June 17th, 1979, in the city of Adelaide in South Australia, a 16-year-old boy named Alan Barnes is hitchhiking home after spending the night with a friend, when a car pulls up next to him. Three friendly men offer him a ride to wherever he's headed. Barnes happily hops into the car, accepts a drink from one of the men, and they go on their way. After this encounter, it will be exactly 1 week before anyone sees Alan Barnes again.
God.
Two hikers find something odd lying on the side of a dirt track leading to the reservoir, and lying on the side of the road under the bridge. When they inspected it, they found it's the twisted, contorted body of Alan Barnes. The look that you gave me.
Oh, here we go.
After doing some investigation.
Like a Stephen King novel, just so you know.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's go.
After doing some investigation, including an autopsy, it was determined that Barnes was picked up on the road by the three men, given some sort of roofie or sedative. Mm. He was then stripped naked, chained up in an unknown room somewhere within the town.
No.
He was kept sedated but still feeling. And from that Sunday the 17th, they kept him alive, repeatedly beat, sexually abused, and tortured him until he eventually died on Friday. Now, here's where it starts getting a little rough, as if it wasn't bad enough already. He died from massive blood loss due to anal trauma.
Dylan!
Yeah. So he was abducted on Sunday, tortured for 5 days. He died on Friday. The perpetrators kept his body for 2 more days.
This is horrible, Dylan.
Yeah, it's not going to get better. So they kept his body for 2 more days. They cleaned it. They basically broke some of his bones and bent him into a smaller shape and then dumped him near the reservoir.
Jesus Christ.
Yes, Jake.
This is the true evil in the world. We talk about it all the time.
Yeah, this one's going to take you some places. It's going to make you feel some things.
Take us some places we do not want to go.
Yes. I read through an article about this, and I listened to a documentary about what had happened. And, whoo, buddy, there's some details in this case. Some of which I have chosen to exclude from the recording that I will tell Jake because I want to ruin his night.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's go.
So that was on, okay, so that was in late June of 1979. So in August 28th, 1979, only 2 months after the discovery of Alan Barnes, a fisherman alone in a disused wharf discovers two stuffed garbage bags sitting out of place. These bags are filled to the brim with the body parts belonging to a 25-year-old named Neil Muir, who had gone missing just 2 days before.
Body parts.
It's, yeah. Detectives inspect the body and find extensive evidence of drugs, sexual assault, torture, and anal trauma. Muir had been killed in a similar fashion to Barnes, with both men dying from blood loss due to the sexual trauma. But the way that they cut up Neil's body stood out to them. So it was a lot more intense than Barnes' relatively intact body dump. In the case of Neil Muir, Muir's head had been cut off and then bizarrely wired back onto his chest. His arms and legs had been cut off and skinned. His chest had been cut open. His organs were removed and placed into the separate garbage bag. And then his legs had been stuffed into his chest cavity.
Oh my God.
And stitched back up.
Yeah. Yep. So it's going to be one of those episodes.
Now it's getting crazy.
Oh yeah.
So with the intense similarities between these two cases, police began suspecting that this was the work of a group of serial killers, and later they received a tip saying that they should look into a number of different people. They started getting a whole lot of tips on this, yeah. But one in particular stood out, and that was Bevan Spencer von Eyman. Von Eyman had been reported as being seen with Neil before his death. Now, police took a look into Von Eyman, but at this point, he doesn't really stand out to them as a key suspect. Seemed like he had a relatively solid alibi, and his name was one of many that came up throughout the investigation.
Okay.
They were really leaning towards the idea that somebody close to Neil Muir had killed him, so they just kind of put Von Eyman back on the back burner here.
Sounds like that was a mistake.
Sounds like that might have been a mistake,
this
huh?
This will play heavily into the end of the story.
This will play heavily into the end of the story.
Of course it will.
More than 2 years later, police are still no closer to finding out who committed these atrocities. And in February of 1982, Mark Langley, a 19-year-old, is celebrating a friend's 18th birthday with his family. So his family decide to leave the party a little bit early and let Mark stay behind to continue celebrating. And a few hours later, Mark vanishes without a trace.
Oh my God.
Last being seen Sunday the 29th after an argument with his friends at the party. The next day, his family called the police to report Mark as missing, and police began an intense search of the areas he was last seen, even bringing in divers to check the river he was walking near. But over the course of the next few days, no evidence of Mark anywhere was found.
This is no good.
No.
I'm not liking this, Dylan.
It is believed that he fell into the same trap as the previous men, getting picked up, hitchhiking, being drugged, and then brutally tortured and assaulted, dying the same way as the previous two men. It will be more than 9 days till anyone finds the remains of Mark. But here's what's odd about this one, is that he's found in the clothes that he left in, you know, the clothes that he was last seen in, they were clean. There was no blood, no fibers on him. He'd been extensively cleaned. He didn't show initially any external injuries. They did find internal trauma, and they did find some other injuries later, but there were no visible bruises or marks, you know, in what was out, you know, arms, face, legs.
Mm-hmm.
And he was missing two pieces of jewelry. But in a postmortem that was done on Langley's body, it was revealed that the other shoe that we've been waiting to drop here was a vertical incision in his abdomen, which had been stitched shut.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to say something to you, Jake. It's believed that the body was cut open to retrieve the object that had been inserted into his intestinal tract. It is believed that the evidence that they inserted and removed might have had evidence linking the murderers to the crime.
Mm-hmm.
So
I get what you're going at. I know. I understand what you're saying.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow. This is just, oh my God.
Yeah.
This has got to be the darkest one we've done.
Yeah, it's definitely up there. It's got to get worse before it gets better.
Okay, keep going.
So with this new body, it further lent itself to the idea that it was a serial killer or killers, and the police continued to work on the tips that they got in. But there is an ever-increasing list of persons of interest, and it's growing overwhelming for police as they reopen case files for other missing persons, fearing that they might have more bodies to find.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The year before Mark Langley went missing, though, a 14-year-old boy named Peter Stogneff went missing on the 27th of August. He skipped school that day without telling his family. He went into the city with a friend, and when his parents returned home from work that day, they found Peter's backpack in the garage, but the boy was nowhere to be found. Until a baffling 10 months later, in June of 1982, which is after Mark Langley was found, a farmer doing a controlled burn of his land, finds a skull along with the severely burned and decomposed remains of what looked like a young boy. And after police arrive and check dental records, they confirmed that it was Peter Stogneff. And upon further investigation, there is evidence of some truly horrific acts done to the 14-year-old.
Oh, God.
Diving right into it, they found his spine had been sawed into repeatedly. His legs had been sawn through above the knees, being removed from the rest of the body, along with the same evidence of sexual assault and torture, although a lot of this evidence was obscured due to decomposition and the intense burns. But the police had every reason to believe that there would be more bodies and that this was connected to their other cases. And still, they are no closer to a solution. You are scowling at me.
I want to solve this case. I'm like, where? Okay, pull out a map of fucking Australia. Let's figure out what the common denominator is. Let's solve this case, Dylan. I'm a grizzled cop. I'm 3 months from retirement. But I am going to solve
getting this case. Getting too old for this shit.
Getting too old for this shit.
This is my swan song.
This is it. This is that case that will haunt me for the rest of my life. I've got to solve it.
Just one last job.
I've got to solve it or I'm going to go fucking mad.
Hell yeah.
Written and directed by David Fincher.
Yep. There it is.
Hell yeah.
We love to see it.
We love it. All right, keep going. Okay. So the most disturbing part is how not disturbed we are about this subject matter. Like I'm eating it up.
Yeah, you say that, but your furrowed brow and glare, like
I want to solve it. Yeah. I want to solve it. I'm three months from retirement, but I, goddamn it, I'm going to solve this case. Go ahead. Keep going.
All right. So again, on June 5th of 1983, a 15-year-old boy named Richard Kelvin, the son of a local news anchor, is abducted, only a short distance from his house. Last seen saying goodbye to his friend at a bus stop near his home.
Dylan, don't do this to me.
His parents waste no time alerting the police, luckily.
Good.
Which leads to them doing a door-to-door canvass of the neighborhood, which actually proved fruitful. As a security guard who lived in the neighborhood said that he heard the sound of car doors banging and what sounded like the yelling of a group of men and one woman and a car with a loud exhaust leaving around 6:30 p.m. And some of the other residents of the neighborhood corroborated the story with similar accounts. And with the boy's father being famous in the area, the news spread like wildfire in the community.
Good.
There's no reason for this boy to leave his family. He had a happy life. He had a girlfriend, lots of friends. And, of course, everyone is fearing that he's been abducted by the same group who's been attacking people over the last couple years. For obvious reason. And 7 weeks after the boy is abducted near his home, it was about 2 months, a man named Trevor Holmes, while taking a hike in the bushlands, stumbles across what looks to be an injured teenager lying in the fetal position. Mm. He goes over to offer assistance when he sees the jumper for Channel 9 that the boy was wearing, along with his greasy hair and cold, discolored skin. Holmes immediately knows that he's found the body of Richard Kelvin.
God damn it.
And he calls the police, who begin a massive search of the area that he was found. Later tests did reveal that he had been drugged in the same way that the other bodies had been found, but this one was a little bit different because Richard had been kept alive for 5 weeks instead of a few days.
Fucking shit, Dylan.
Eventually being killed, intensely washed, redressed, and dumped in the bushland where his body will remain for a week or two before it gets discovered. And as the news grows on these cases and the murders begin piling up, the media runs wild with the story and dubs the mysterious group of killers The Family.
Ooh.
Yes.
That's a good name.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, what is that? What are those movies that you like? The Rob Zombie movies? Devil's Rejects?
Yeah.
I don't watch those.
Oh, man, those are good.
Yeah, you say that.
They're fucking good, man. House of a Thousand Corpses?
Never seen it.
I cannot believe you have not seen House of a Thousand Corpses.
I think we have it, don't we?
Yes, of course I have it.
I'm not going to watch that by myself.
Target was doing a Steelbook exclusive of House of a Thousand Corpses, Devil's Rejects, and Three from Hell. I was there as soon as Target opened, almost, and I got the last one. Not so fucking happy with it. Anyway, back to this horrible, horrible story.
Yes.
The police keep working through the evidence that they have on these bodies. They're going through any sort of fibers they can find, the damage, their clothing, anything they can look into. Now, the murder of this newest boy, Richard, had actually proven to be more useful to police than the others, as they were finally able to get enough trace evidence back and get some information back on the drug screen. They were able to find out exactly which drugs had been used to intoxicate the boy, one of which is a difficult drug to get a hold of. It was called Mandrax. So what they did was they looked through a list of people who had been prescribed this drug and then cross-referenced that with their list of names that they got from tips.
And who comes to the top of the list?
They came across a familiar name, Bevan Spencer von Eymann.
God damn it.
Detectives visit von Eymann in his home that he shares with his mother, and they start by asking which prescription drugs he has in the house. They do a brief investigation of his home and his car, which led to the discovery of a few different drugs hidden behind a mirror in his bedroom.
Here we go.
Some of which were in the systems of the boys that they found. Police took him in and directly asked him if he knew or killed any of the boys that they found. Of course, he denies everything. He actually even offers up samples of his hair and blood so that they can do DNA testing.
Well, because he knows that he's wiped all the DNA evidence clean off of the bodies that they found.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, von Eymann is suspect number one, but unfortunately, police need even more evidence to build a strong enough case to actually take him to court.
Okay.
But upon their investigation, they find out that von Eymann has been interrogated about the disappearance of another young man a couple years ago, and because of his connection to a group of disgusting men with a proclivity towards young boys. And as police began searching more, they located the first person who actually gave them a tip leading them towards von Eymann a few years ago. This was one of those anonymous calls or unnamed calls that had come in. This was the first one, and they actually located this person and brought him in for questioning. Now, the witness's name has been completely redacted, and he's known only as Mr. B. But he tells police he was one of the men who was with von Eymann.
That's what I thought he was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And that he saw firsthand what they did to the boys. He described in great detail the routine, the process, they took in selecting the boys, drugging and kidnapping, the torture, etc. He's got all of this first-hand account information. Now, this testimony helps greatly in their case against von Eymann, but they still don't have quite enough until the investigation continues and they find evidence in his home that match fibers and particles on Richard Kelvin's body. These fibers came from two distinctive and vibrant rugs that he had in his bedroom and his hallway. And after testing von Eymann's DNA, they found that his hair matched a single strand of hair that they had found in Richard Kelvin's jeans.
Bingo.
Bingo.
We got this motherfucker.
Leading to the official arrest and charging of Bevan von Eymann for the murder of Richard Kelvin.
I'm going to solve this case or I'm going to die trying.
And on October 15th, 1984, Bevan von Eymann goes to trial. He admits that he picked up Richard, but he tried to play off the evidence. He tried to say that he just picked him up and gave him a ride, that he took him back to his house to, like, hang out or give him food or some shit. He says that he, you know, put his arm around him at one point, and that would be why there was evidence there. But they said, no, we found him 7 weeks after you supposedly hung out with him. If you're not the one who took him, all that evidence would have fallen off of him by now, or there would be new evidence. Obviously, the evidence against him is just too damning and too plentiful, and after a trial that went on for almost 3 weeks, the jury retires to find their verdict. And after deliberating, they say, guilty for the murder of Richard Kelvin. Oh,
thank God.
He is initially sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole within 25 years, but the jury comes together. Yeah, they come together and they overturn that sentencing and replace it with life in prison with no possibility of parole for 36 years instead of the 25, which was the highest sentence ever for somebody in South Australia at that time, which is good. Mm-hmm. However, not quite done. We got one more little section in here, and then I will let you free from this nightmare. Now, following the trial of Von Eymann, police re-interviewed Mr. B, who has been granted immunity in exchange for more evidence linking Von Eymann to the other murders. Because as of right now, they have only convicted him with the murder of the young boy, Richard.
Yeah, Richard Kelvin.
Yeah, Richard Kelvin. So none of the others have been connected officially to him yet. But March 5th, 1990... Von Eymann is taken back into court for the murders of the other two boys. Of course, he pleads not guilty, but Mr. B testifies to the court that he saw Von Eymann with the first two boys. Now, as they worked with the judge and with the prosecutors and defenders, they determined that they would be allowed to go basically to the next step of the trial if they wanted to, but they wouldn't be able to use any of the evidence that they had from Richard Kelvin's trial.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, all they have is the testimony of Mr. B, and it just wasn't strong enough to actually take to the Supreme Court. So, there was no way of knowing for sure if he did the other murders, because they tried to pursue this one, and he was just acquitted from it. They couldn't follow up with the other ones.
Right.
Still in prison, so he's still facing justice for the murder of Richard. But, unfortunately, we have no idea, like, if he did for sure the other murders, which we're pretty sure he did.
Yeah.
But we don't know how many other murders he may have committed during his 10 years of operation.
God almighty.
Or who else he was working with.
I know. I was thinking that too. Where are his accomplices?
Exactly. Von Eymann has never given up any additional information, but many people suspect that the number of bodies could actually have gotten closer to 100 within his time frame. And that there may be as many as 2 to 4 other people that had worked with him on these murders. But as of right now, all we know is that they found evidence of just a couple of them, and we have no idea who else did this with him. So we know Von Eymann, who's in prison, Mr. B, who's been given immunity, and anybody else involved is just out there now.
This is some true detective bullshit.
This is some true detective shit. Yep. And that's it.
Oh my God.
That's it. There is like half of a happy ending in there, like a quarter of a happy ending in there, in that he is in prison. But that's the only upside of this story.
That was the darkest story we've ever done.
I think so, yeah.
That was the worst.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
Appreciate it. You are most welcome. And on that delightful note, if you want to give us money,
yeah, so we can keep doing
this. So we can keep talking about this. Please do that. You can support us through Anchor or Patreon, or you can, you know, just send us money if you like us. Also, if you can tell anybody about our show that you think they may like, you know, we would love to get more listeners on here. If you want a good episode for them to listen to,
don't pick this one.
Send them to this one. No. Just start them off on the deep end, because it can't get any worse than this.
It's going to take a lot to get worse than that one. That one was hard.
Oh, yeah. I'm really going to work on upping my game for the next one. We'll see.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But anyway.
People are horrible.
Yeah. People are absolutely terrible.
Thanks for that, Dylan. Appreciate that.
But yeah, we have Instagram. We have Patreon. We have TikTok. We have Google, Gmail, whatever the fuck that is.
It's Gmail.
Gmail. So lots of ways for you guys to get in contact with us. If you want to send us any cool stories or suggestions, or you just want to say hi and become part of the network. But thank you all so much for listening. And if you know anybody that would like to listen, just like I said, send them our way. Maybe don't start them out on this episode, I guess.
start them out on a lighter one, you know, about alien abduction.
Yeah. Let them hear about anal probes from aliens, and then you can get into evil.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I think that's it, right?
Yeah, that's it for me. Thank you all.
Oh, God. All right. Well, from Dylan, my co-host, my name is Jake, and we hope we've left you too scared to sleep.
I know Jake is.
Oh, my God. I'm too scared to sleep now.
Scarlet Witch, okay. Scarlet Witch outfit, though, that was really doing it for me. Sure. I'm just going to put that out
there. Don't look at me in the eye when you say things like that. At least look away. Oh, my goodness. No,
direct and intense eye contact.
That's the rule about a devil's threesome is you don't look the other guy in the eye unless you're going to high five.
Oh, boy. Oh, high five? Ew.
That's according to Barney. I never watched How I Met Your Mother. I thought that show was stupid.
And yeah, I couldn't get into it.
And God forgive me, I've never watched The Big Bang Theory either.
That's fine. That show sucks. I hate The Big Bang Theory.
That's what I've heard. So those are two shows that I've never watched.
Yeah, don't waste your time with them.